This is a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, June 14th, 1989, at 1:15, Hearing Room 343. We have a work session on House Bill 2127A, 2251A, 2282A, 2469A, 2470A, 2488. Public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2164, 2325, 2326A, and 2995.
Let's come to order and start out with House Bill 2164. We have Secretary of State Bob Roberts here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll try to go through as quickly as I can the reason for the bill, the rationale. In the early part of 1988, a group of individuals representing the title and escrow and real estate industries contacted my office requesting that we draft legislation to restore credibility to notaries public. This request was a result of a great increase in the number of fraudulent real estate transactions involving notaries. The Secretary of State currently is responsible for the processing of notary public commissions but has no enforcement authority to regulate the notarial functions. So in April of 1988, I appointed a notary public task force made up of the financial, escrow, real estate industries, attorneys, county clerks, court reporters, and the governor's office. My office conducted a survey of all of the other 49 states and compiled information for the task force to use in drafting the legislation. A.N. Gross House Bill 2164 is important legislation. The bill ensures competency and accountability in the performance of notary public functions. As amended, House Bill 2164 provides centralized administration of the notary public functions by transferring the commissioning and the revocation authority from the governor to the Secretary of State, so the whole function for notary publics is centralized in one agency. It requires notaries to maintain a chronological log of notarial acts with exceptions provided by administrative rule through our office. It requires an open book exam on the part of the applicants when they fill their application form out, so it increases the understanding of notary functions so that the mistakes that are being made are not being replicated by lack of knowledge. It has a very broad endorsement base from both the National and American Notary Associations, the title associations here in Oregon, the state chartered banks, the mortgage banks, the League of Financial Institutions, the Escrow Council, and the Credit Union League. Some of the kinds of things that were happening that created the need for the legislation is that there were real estate transactions involving notarization of fraudulent documents, and we began to find that happening all over the state, and a lot of times they were fraudulent and could have been caught if the notaries had been following common knowledge of what their role was. We had notaries witnessing or attesting to signatures without any kind of evidence of identification, and that's not supposed to happen, but many of them don't have the training to know what they need to do. We had incorrect or incomplete notarizations. In fact, 28% of all the notarized documents received for certification in our office had to be returned for correction. We had notaries overcharging beyond what the law allowed. We had illegible notary seals and signatures on all kinds of documents, some of great importance. And we had notaries that did not update their commission name and address, so about 30% of the notary applications we sent out for renewal came back because we didn't even know where those notaries lived and they didn't even think about the importance of keeping that updated. So the misuse of those notary powers has become a national issue, not just here in Oregon, but across the country. And legislatures across the nation are now adopting notary public standards to try to avoid the kind of problem that we now have. Oregon's response, I believe, is timely and responsible, and I believe Oregon citizens and businesses will be much better served by these changes in our notary law. So we bring this bill to you today with very strong support. I think very good amendments made while it was in the House of Representatives to take away some concerns that I think were legitimate. And I think it's a fine piece of legislation, and I would hope for the support of the committee.
Other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I haven't looked at this bill before, Barbara, but I was interested in your comment about the requirement that notaries keep a log of everything they notarize. How's that to work? Could you enlarge on that a little bit? I mean, I am a notary, as most lawyers are, and I'm just
so have I been in the past.
How is that going to work?
There was some concern about the log at first because people thought it was a lot of work. But one of the things it does is to make certain that there is a record of what you've notarized. If someone came back to you and say, you know that document you notarized in November of 1986, most of us would have no idea what we've notarized and couldn't prove that it was fraudulent or not fraudulent because we'd have no duplicative record. And part of what the log does is to make sure that you've required the identification format and other kinds of things. It's recorded. I mean, it's just like keeping a book and saying, I notarized for Senator Shoemaker a certain kind of document and used such and such as evidence, and there it is. And so what it does is prevent an abuse of people saying, oh, yeah, the notary did this for me. And so one of the things it does is to give us the kind of record and all really protects both the businesses who are having things notarized and also protects the notary from someone saying they've notarized something later that they in fact have not.
Well, wouldn't the document speak for itself? I mean, that would be the obvious question. I mean, either it's notarized or it isn't.
I'm going to let Carol Irwin from my office comment on that. She's been working with the committee that put together the bill as well as following it in the House, and maybe Carol would like to comment on that.
The thing that we're finding...
Your name, please, Carol.
My name is Carol Irwin, Madam Chairman.
Thank you.
I'm Rules and Records Manager in the Public Records Division. I work directly with the notary section, and some of the things that we're seeing and encountering in our complaint area is that documents are being dated, in some cases months or even years after the notarization took place. Had there been a journal entry, there would have been proof that this happened at a particular point in time. Otherwise, there is no way to record that happening.
Do you require that a copy be made of the notarized document?
No. The journal itself would have an entry for listing the type of document that was notarized. It also has a place where the person who is signing the document signs in the journal. So there's a duplication of the signature as well.
You mean the notary has to sign the journal each time?
The person signing the document signs the document and signs an entry in the journal.
So you have the date on file, you have the record, the kind of document it was, and if there's ever any question later about the document, if there's a court challenge or a legal case, you have clearly, I mean, it's really easy to take something that's shown, for instance, notarized in 1981 and make that 1987. It would not be very difficult to do that. And there are a number of other numbers, for instance, that are easy to change, and this log would be chronological, so it would say, well, it'd be a little difficult to do that in 1987 because we can show it in our log in 1981.
Yeah, I'm assuming that what would happen is it would, as I go in to have something notarized, which I have to do momentarily someplace here, that I would have to sign both the piece of paper that I'm to notarize and I'd sign the journal. As the client, or whatever you would call me at that
point.
It is possible under the present law for a notary to acknowledge a document without having the person actually sign the document in front of the notary. You can't use the subscribed and sworn to before me, obviously, but you can use acknowledged before me. And if you know the person, and know the person's voice, you can do it on the telephone.
Is that fair?
And have that person acknowledge on the telephone that, yes, I did sign that document.
Not legally you can't, Senator.
I've been told that you could.
I think that's probably the problem here. We have had years of trying to fuss with notaries and people falsely holding themselves as notary publics for all sorts of good and bad reasons, and so it's probably a reason. Barbara, you want to...
Yeah, I just want to comment. I think you'll find when one of the people who signed up to testify on this will tell you out of a very prominent large law firm in Portland recently, a multi-massive dollar document was mishandled in the law office, both in terms of what the law office believed it could do and what the notary believed they could do. And so we found that a number of people in the law profession did not understand the legal rules as they related to notary publics. There's a lot of assumptions about what can be done that legally cannot be done. And that's part of the reason for the open book test, so people really do understand what their legal obligations are as a notary. We think of it as a small job, and in a sense it is, but its application to very large financial transactions and real estate transactions and deeds and other things of that nature have made it a very important role, and we've not done a very good job of training and informing and educating those who do the process.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay. Further questions?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
Frank Brauer.
Speaking for all three, right?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Frank Brauer with the Oregon Bankers Association. We support the passage of House Bill 2164, and we consider it to be a very important bill. It was my opportunity to serve on the task force. I was appointed by the Secretary of State. I reluctantly participated because I've been a notary for a long time. One of the one-liners I use when someone reads my entire biography and introduction for a speech is, you left out the fact that I'm a notary public, and that always gets a laugh. And frankly, it was my desire that we do away with notaries, that I believed that there was no reason for this process. I soon discovered how wrong I was. I also learned a great deal about the law that I didn't know. I understood that the necessity for notaries in real estate transactions, there's no other way that you could operate, and international transactions demand notary and so forth. Then I discovered all of the misuses and misunderstandings. This bill's had a thorough going over in the House. I wanted to point out to Senator Shoemaker, in the bill there is an exception to the journal that may be granted by administrative rule by the Secretary of State. Broadcasters raised a concern in the House that something that we had not contemplated. They keep a log when the spot when the advertisement airs, and each of those has to be notarized. So they're already keeping a log, so the Secretary of State, in response to that, has determined that by administrative rule, that log, that broadcast log, will be their nocturnal log, and they will not have to keep two logs. There could be other exceptions, probably are, that can be handled in that manner. I'd be happy to respond to any questions. I think it's a very important bill that needs to pass this session.
Other questions? Thank you, Frank. Al Rasmus and Don McKelvey, you may as well both come up at once.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. I'm Al Rasmus, co-owner of American Pacific Title, also representing the Oregon Escrow Council. I need to give this over here. That was a handout of some examples that have gone on. Didn't want to go through those in great detail. I was a member of the task force also that met for several months. The Oregon Escrow Council very much supports this bill, worked very hard on it. The bill, the primary things that come out of this from an industry standpoint, one is education. As been mentioned before, too many people do not know all the rules. We find from a title and escrow standpoint, when documents come in to record from outside, which we get a lot of them from, lenders, attorneys, other people that are not in the profession, because there's 40,000 notaries in the state of Oregon. A lot of them are the little mom and pop on the corner type people that are not doing this on a day-by-day basis like we are. I would say close to 40 to 45% of the ones we get in that are other than a husband and wife type notary or a simple corporate notary are done incorrectly. The people just don't know how to do a partnership, how to do a witness one, how to do a power of attorney and so forth. And every time something like that is done wrong, it delays the transaction, obviously in recording documents, the county clerk's office doesn't even check the notaries that thoroughly to know if it's the proper type. They look for a seal and a signature. So sometimes documents get recorded, and it's not until several years later trying to track it down that we come up with the problem. So education, very important. And the test will take care of at least showing that the people have read the book. The log is important, has been mentioned, for checking ID. There's too many situations I've seen in the industry where somebody comes in and says, my wife couldn't get down here today. She signed off on the house. Here's her signature on the document. I'll sign in front of you. Would you notarize both signatures? Can't do that. You know, in a lot of cases, we found where the wife did not sign it with the husband or somebody else signing the document and bringing it in. So those are the types of problems that a log would prove. You'd prove that somebody came in, you'd have the ID. The seal also, it hasn't been mentioned yet, but right now you can go down and buy the squisher seal, as we call it. Anybody can. I can walk into Cook Stationery down here, order a seal with my name on it, and pretend I'm a notary, put an expiration date down. No other proof. The control now using, one, a seal that can be seen, because the embosser cannot be seen on microfilm. You'd have a seal which would have a name of the notary plus the notary number, and the control in being able to produce that is very important. Last, we can't really stop con men on fraud. That's going to occur. Somebody wants to go through all the trouble of forging and even the new stamp and all this. We can't stop those. But what we can stop is a lot of the things that come up from ignorance and not showing ID, proving ID, having a spouse come in that's really a girlfriend, the wife, or girlfriend, the husband and the wife divorces in another county. Title company doesn't know there's a divorce. Somebody signs it, and a notary down in some other city notarizes it and comes back to you. You don't have the proof. Then years later, you need to go back and prove that it was fraudulent or stop the deterrent in front so it won't happen. So basically, the bill is very important to our industry. We're seeing more and more claims, more and more problems with incorrect and fraudulent notaries. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions?
Question I have, and it's occurred to me from time to time, if a notary doesn't know from prior relationship the identity of the person that asks that for the signature to be notarized, and then that person represents him or herself as someone other than who they really are and signs a signature that is not their signature, and the notary's duty, I would assume, is to somehow or other satisfy himself that the person is who he represents himself to be. What if you err in that regard?
Okay. The log is mentioned has a place for identification. So you would ask for a driver's license or some other form of identification to prove that it is the person. The notary does have a responsibility, even at this point in time. I know one situation where a title company is suing a notary because the lady did not see the people. The woman called up over the phone and said, I'm sending my son down with a document I signed. Please notarize it. They found out later on it's forged.
Well, no, not that case, but okay. Where the person actually, you actually have the signatures performed before you, but it's
You would still have the liability if they found later on that it was a forged signature.
Is it an absolute responsibility on the part of the notary to be correct in that regard?
I would say yes. It is at this point in time, and this bill doesn't change anything there, but it makes it more important in the notary's mind to check the ID instead of just automatically notarizing it because the person signed it in front of them. They make them, put down their identification with their driver's license, whatever, and then also sign the log.
What is the extent of that liability?
That I'm honestly not sure what the, I'm sure there are civil liabilities based in there.
Is there liability for damages caused by a false document?
Don's an attorney.
Maybe I can answer. I'm Don McKelvey. I'm counsel with First American, Vice President and counsel with First American Title. I'm also appearing on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. I think that probably the responsibility of a notary is to exercise reasonable care to identify the individual. And I think that's basically seeking reasonable identification. I think that if a notary does that, those are things that would be recorded in the log. Now, if they've given you something that is not, that's beyond your ability as a notary to, you can't fingerprint them and run them through a blood check and everything else. But I think, I believe that probably the liability caused by failing to, negligently performing this act probably is the amount of the loss that's caused by the, whether or not someone can collect that. And I guess that's one of the main things that this bill, I don't think that was the primary intent of it, but I think having been a notary myself in the past, I look back and it scares the daylights out of me to think of someone coming up and saying that your identification on this document has been challenged. And I don't have anything to show what I did to identify that person. So I think that that's something that will bring a lot of peace of mind to notaries. I don't think they realize it now, and I think there are a lot of them that are very uncomfortable with this idea of a notary journal. But I think I've probably answered your question. I'll let you go ahead.
Thank you.
One just quick comment on that. Many of the title and escrow companies in the state of Oregon have already instituted on their own instituted logs to protect themselves from this situation now. And the public and the people that are dealing with the logs, at first, you know, the typical reaction is it's going to be an imposition on people. We never had to ask them for ID before, et cetera, et cetera. Has not been a problem. When they go to Fred Meyer and cash a check for grocery, they got to show ID. So when they're signing their house away or borrowing $100,000, they should be showing ID, too, to prove who they are.
This point that he just commented on, my company, I think, was the company that first started utilizing notary journals. They require them in California, and our company just thought for good, sound practice, it would be a good idea. And we introduced them to some of the other companies, and some of them at first viewed that with just tremendous trepidation. They thought, well, we're going to offend people. I said, what do you mean you're going to offend them? They've got to ask for ID anyway. Well, gee, some of these people we think we should know and so on. We're afraid to ask them for ID, and we find that that is just pervasive, just everywhere that's happening. And this journal is going to be, it's the thing, you want me to notarize your signature? I need to have your ID so I can fill out my journal. It's going to make it so easy for people to ask for ID for doing something that they need to do, and in so many cases they're not doing now. And it will provide a business record for them to go back and protect themselves later. This is really one of the keystones of this bill.
If the notary does in fact know the person, do you still have to have them produce identification and then identify that identification in the log? Or can you say known
personally known? I think that you could do that. If I'm not just sure, and that's something that the Secretary of State's office, the exact form, the form that we use for First American Title is not one that requires a signature of the individual. I think that the idea is good. We do it, and we're just keeping a record of the document and the date, the name of the individual, and the identification used, and we've instructed our people that if they are personally known, I mean, they do know who they are, that is acceptable. Now, that may or may not, I don't know just what the guidelines that the Secretary of State's going to utilize on that.
I take it it's left up to the discretion of the Secretary of State to prescribe the form of journal that will be used.
Basically so, I believe so, yes.
I leaped through this and didn't find it in the bill.
Yeah, the form that was discussed in committee and the sample that were used in the task force when we went through this did include a box that was checked that said personally known. All you have to do is check the box. And it'll probably be up to each individual company as far as like title and escrow companies. We may require people to show ID all the time, but the Secretary of State's office, I believe, will use the one that has checking a box.
Okay.
Thank you.
Al, any further comments? Don?
I think most of my testimony is in my written comments, and unless you have questions, I'll be glad to answer any questions. I don't think I need to. A lot of what I have in there has been spoken by previous speakers.
Question, you had a comment? Yes, Senator, I had communications from two people in support of the bill. One was Corey Streisinger out of the governor's office, and the other was Toby Graff, who is speaking on behalf of the practice and procedures section of the bar, and they approve the bill as drafted without amendments.
Good. Okay.
Are there any other comments, any other questions?
Interested in a work session? On this?
Senator Hill's about to move it.
Yes, Madam Chair, move House Bill 2164 to support the due pass recommendation.
Unamended. Any other comments, questions to Senator Hill's motion moving House Bill 2164 to the floor of the due pass recommendation? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Aye.
Roger.
Aye.
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 Hill.
Aye.
Aye.
All right, motion carried. Thank you very much. Let's go to House Bill 2995. And we have a floor session today at what time?
3:15.
3:15.
3:15?
3:15.
Okay.
Oh.
We have a sign-up sheet from the Municipal Judges Association, Janice Zerganoff, and who else is here on this bill? John Gervais, 2995. And Eric Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Eric Carlson with the League of Oregon Cities. This bill was a gut and stuff on the House side. It is designed to solve a particular problem by municipal judges who are appointed by more than one city. The Commission on Judicial Fitness has ruled that holding more than one municipal judge position is a violation of a constitutional provision on dual lucrative offices. These are part-time positions. They are generally held by people who donate part of their time to the city in the sense they aren't paid a whole lot. And the bill simply says that for purposes of creating municipal judgeships that cities and counties may have Chapter 190 agreements to provide those municipal court services, and that a judge who serves under one of those is not holding dual lucrative offices. It's a bill that's important to cities outside of the valley, some cities in the valley, but many cities out of the valley, because they rely on judges who are essentially circuit riders to handle their municipal courts, and they handle a number of small ordinance violations that allow people to appear in court close to home rather than traveling 20 to 50 miles to a county seat. So the League would very much appreciate your prompt consideration and passage of 2995.
Okay, and does this have any material effect on practice and anything else, doing anything else other than what you suggested to us here?
Not that I'm aware of, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
How important is it to you that this have an emergency clause in it?
Well, it would be very.
It is, Senator Shoemaker, Madam Chair, it's important because there are judges who are now serving more than one city, and one of the purposes of the bill would be for the legislature to ratify what has happened to this point and prevent defendants from being able to go back and say, because there was a dual office at some time in the past, that I was not properly convicted.
I'm willing to sell that to Senator Otto if necessary.
Okay, identify yourself, please.
For the record, my name is John Gervais from the Municipal Judges Association. Just like your positive consideration of the bill.
Thank you. Janice?
I have nothing to add. There is some written testimony. I am here on behalf of the Municipal Judges Association, and I also the Justice of the Peace Association has also backed this bill. I would be willing to answer questions if there are any. I will add that I'm the municipal judge for the City of Woodburn, the City of Aurora, Justice of the Peace for the North Marion District, and also for the City of Mount Angel. So I am one of these that's directly affected by riding a circuit, so to speak.
Are there other questions?
Madam Chair? Are you so inclined?
I am. Let me just wait till Senator Shoemaker gets finished reading the bill, and then I'll take the motion.
I think it's fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2995 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay. Senator Grinsky has moved House Bill 2995 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please. Senator
Brennan?
Aye.
Rothman?
Aye.
Grinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Aye.
Freeman?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's move to, I can't tell which one you have. 2326, let's take the one we just took off the floor this morning. 2326, relating to architects, actually. Catherine?
Yes, Senator. I believe this was referred for a review of the civil penalty provisions. As currently written, the civil penalty provisions are not adequate, and I have some boilerplate language. However, I'd like to call, we need to, there's one choice point in there. I'll pass out the amendments now, and I'll explain the decision point.
What are we on?
2326.
Thank you.
Relates to architects and civil penalties.
Phil Patterson is here from Medford. Why don't you come on up, Phil? From the State Board of Architectural Examiners.
I'm just going to tell you, I have the handle of this version that is slightly different than the one I passed out, and it deals with the language in here.
Fine.
Would you want to take a look at it? And then there may be a third version, actually, that does what I...
I thought it was important to voice the general objection to 2325 now for about three-quarter of the practicing LMTs in Oregon. This is based on three surveys that we've had.
Okay, could you just comment on whether 1,000 hours, 750 hours, 500 hours, 333 hours, or 150 hours? And I
we
guess
feel
that's what you
that
think.
The 333 hours was a very positive and creative compromise, and
thank you.
We feel we've
thanks for coming.
Senator Shoemaker pointed out that July 1991 date is in the bill.
Yes.
Okay.
And so my motion would just be to change the 1,000 hours to 333.
Thank you. Senator Brennerman has moved the deletion of 1,000 and to add 333, to substitute 333. Are there objections to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
I think the bill is in order with a conceptual amendment that...
I'll move 2325 as amended to the floor of the due pass.
Okay. Senator Brennerman has moved House Bill 2325 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 We can't tell you apart.
Where am I?
Excuse me. Votes aye.
Aye. And Grinsky, the court is excused for the moment.
I'm covering for him.
Okay. Okay, let's take two little quick ones and then get on to the main business. 21, do you have any left, Catherine? 21, 27. 21, 27 are technical amendments. We hope that are... These bills are brought back because the sponsors are finding technical amendments. And I think there's nothing else about that, but let's check. 2127 is the bill dealing with judgments and docketing. Who's here to talk about that?
Karen Hightower.
Karen Hightower, okay. Don't go away too long, folks. Don't go far.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hightower, Assistant Legal Counsel with the State Court Administrator. These are technical amendments, simply just changing a little bit of the language in the last subsection 2 on page 2 clarifies that a notice of appeal could be sent by first-class registered or certified mail. Before it had just said first-class mail. It adds back in the language that the date of serving such notice shall be the date of mailing. It's a little bit clearer language. We're just trying to clear that up.
Okay, regards, and you have the allowance of other types of mailing as well there, right?
Right.
That's on page 2. The chair would move that we reconsider the vote by which we sent 2127 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. We do need to officially retrieve it and reconsider that vote. Is there objection to that reconsideration? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, now the bill is before us. Anything else? Catherine?
There was another, there was an error in the conflicting amendments on line 28, page 2. A shall was a may, and this puts it back into order to a shall. It was basically a technical typographical error down in Legislative Council.
Okay.
It was
fixed up on review. To tell him that they do check these things, to demonstrate to you, Senator Shoemaker, that the conflict amendments do get checked.
Good thing.
We didn't set it up this way.
Catherine? I was going to say, unfortunately, the error was found by Karen Hightower on her review, or fortunately.
Oh.
And then this 8-8 amendment encompasses all the amendments we adopted before. We had adopted a dash 2, which was from the court administrator's office, and then this one that we're correcting now was actually, I believe, a dash 4 amendment, and that came in response to the Heen case, which came down on May 17th. It was... Anyway, that was the second amendment. The third thing we adopted were the conflict of amendments, and so this dash A8 corrects all problems and is an entity unto itself. It's all of the amendments that are necessary.
So if you want to amend, you can amend A8.
I don't want to amend. I just want to clarify. I heard the discussion that the portion of the A8 amendments that appears between line 6 and 13 on page 2 was changed from, I assume, A7 or whatever preceded first-class registered or certified mail, and making it clear that the date of serving such notice shall be the date of mailing, but no comment was made regarding the proof of mailing shall be certified by the party filing the notice and file their action with the court, which is different from the proof of mailing necessary in the filing the notice of appeal itself. And do I understand correctly?
Yes, it is different, Senator.
This 8 amendment makes a change in that regard, too, as I have just mentioned.
Yes, Senator. It does two changes from what was passed out before. It does, as you indicated, add registered or certified mail, and it does and it brings in language that we deleted out of the amendment that was in front of us before, which talks about proof of mailing. Proof of mailing for notice of appeal is now different than the proof that is necessary for the filing. There is a difference in it. Yes, Senator, and it is intentional.
Right. I just wanted to make sure we had all that on the record. Okay.
Are there, the chair would move the dash A8 LC amendments dated 6/14/89. Are there objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. The chair would move House Bill 2127 back to the floor. Whoever was the real carrier will carry it again. Are there discussion?
Just quick.
Senator Springer.
I think I asked Mr. Linden when he was here earlier on this bill and these amendments to assure me that the Council on Court Procedures had signed off on this. And he assured me that they had, and I just want to make sure that's still the case. And I'm getting an affirmative nod from Mr. Swank from the State Court Administrator's Office. Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're moving it to the floor
as we
further
amended.
Yes.
And the dash A8 consumes all of the other amendments we made on the bill previously, puts them in one place, and fixes it.
Correct the motion, yes. Which is not correct and clean as you said.
Okay. Are we... call the roll, please, on House Bill 2127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Brennan.
Aye.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Gruske. Senator Hill.
Aye.
Senator Schumann.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Chair Collins.
Aye. Thank you very much. Okay, let's move to 2470. Let's deal with 2488 first.
And we have an amendment to this bill.
This is the sailor bill. Basically, it's a new bill.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if you look at the amendment, you're looking at the whole thing, and the amendment is from the Bankers Association.
This is the Representative Saylor bill, if you remember. And it had to do with the Beth Mason, had to do with child support payments or that were listed and docketed or not docketed.
Right. Apparently, a couple had been denied credit because appearing on their credit rating was the fact that there was a satisfied child support judgment. This bill changes. One of the concerns I believe the committee had was that the remedies before included specific performance, which probably is a incorrect remedy when there has not yet been a contract made. The other thing literally read requiring specific performance may have required the creditors to extend credit where there may have been other reasons that they wanted to not, or legitimate reasons other than treating the child support obligation differently, which would have been the basis for denying credit. This rewrites the remedy section, and now the remedies say that the party adversely affected by a creditor's violation of this section can have a cause of action to recover compensatory damages and may also apply to the court for an injunction to prevent the creditor's further violation of the act.
That's in substitute to your performance.
And that's in language. Section 3 in substitution for the specific performance language. There is another issue in Section 1, and I think we need to make clear on the record what the intent of the committee is, if that's the intent of the committee. When you read Section 1, it says, in evaluating applications for extension of credit, a creditor shall treat the obligation of the applicant to play support no more adversely than the creditor treats any other obligation for the same amount, terms, and duration of the child support obligation.
That's exactly as it's printed.
Yeah,
that's exactly as
there.
It's printed, yes. And I believe that the intent is there. Just Oregon is relatively unique in that all child support obligations are reduced to judgments. Judgments and are often treated adversely by creditors just by the fact that they exist as a judgment. And I believe the intent here is to say, just because it is a judgment, don't treat it adversely like you treat judgments. Treat it as you would an ongoing credit obligation.
Catherine has made the rounds with a whole group of people to sort of work this through today once again, and I would like to get it on its way, and I suppose, like everything else around here, we have ways to get it back if it isn't, once again, correct. Catherine does believe it is in having taken out the performance language, which is really what we've changed here. And clarified what that is. We're probably in a position where the bill doesn't necessarily do a lot except for the preamble.
The only change it makes from the A and Gross bill, I think, is to take out the specific performance remedy.
Right.
That's really
yes.
The only change, isn't
that,
it? I've been trying to sort of track the two, and I don't see that
yes.
There's any other difference here.
Yes. Section 1 remains the same. I just wanted to talk about the intent in case the word obligation, to give some definition to obligation and to terms.
Okay.
Madam Chair, do you want to move then the proposed substitute?
Well, I guess, I think that's true with the understanding that that really... Why did we have that one? We really could just say taken out specific performance.
Is this the same then as the bill except for
That's my understanding, Senator, yes.
What is it that you have taken on the rounds? Was it this, or?
Yes. Yes, it was, Senator.
Madam Chair, with the understanding this will be legislatively, go through legislative council, then why don't I move this, Madam Chair, title proposed substitute for HB 2488. I move those amendments.
Okay. Senator Springer.
Yeah, just a quick question. It doesn't seem like there's much remedy here really left, but don't we have federal laws that relate to requirements in terms of federal lending laws? And I just want to make sure we're not running afoul of any federal lending rules in terms of credit, risk, et cetera. And the other question is, I want to make sure that we don't, by adopting this, affect any other remedy a person may have at common law if they've suffered as a result of what may be argued as tortious interference with a business relationship or some other common law remedy. In other words, this remedy is very narrow, and I want to make sure we're not adversely affecting any other remedy which may exist out there.
Frank?
Madam Chair, Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. In response to Senator Springer's question, Reg B deals directly with equal credit opportunity, mandates that child support, both the income must be considered, the expense must be considered just as another obligation. There is a body of other law, federal law, that deals with the handling of child support. These amendments were presented to the House Committee, and that's why you see Section 1 and 2 as the same. The specific performance was the House Committee's idea. There's another change here. Understand there is the injunction.
Oh.
That is not contained in the printed
bill.
Yes. Now, Senator Springer, in direct response to the other part of your question, we drafted this to make sure that there was no conflict with Reg B or any other federal enactment or regulation. It is our sincere belief that the parties that were harmed had a course of action against the fuel oil company and that Reg B had been violated. The problem you have is, as a retailer, it is the Federal Trade Commission that is supposed to be their regulator. They are covered by Reg B, and it is supposed to be the FTC, and they have nobody in the field to make sure that people comply. They just aren't very effective. So the fuel oil, probably they don't understand that Reg B exists, and if they do, they don't understand probably that they're subject to it. This will assist, we think, by placing it in the Oregon statute, to the extent that it's possible to assist without conflicting with Reg B, and that's why we drafted it this way. We also considered that there would be no, and it is not intended, to replace any case law or common law remedy that might exist today or any other kind of redress that might exist.
I appreciate that's reassuring, and I could support the motion, I guess, or the amendments that have been presented with that understanding.
A couple of questions. The attorney's fee clause provides that if damages are awarded, the plaintiff will be entitled to attorney fees from the creditor. I wonder if it would be fair to make that reciprocal so that the prevailing party in any such case would be entitled to attorney's fees, so that a frivolous case could result in attorney's fees against the plaintiff.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we certainly would.
I would think you would resist that.
Senator Springer?
My recollection is part of tort reform we've provided that
so.
There is a remedy for a frivolous case now in existing law that applies across the board.
Well,
not as specific as attorney's fees. I'm not sure the specific sanctions, but.
I guess I'm not interested in moving off into this. We've got three more bills left. We've got a few minutes. I guess I'm not interested in, I personally am not interested in
getting into
rewriting some more about who's entitled to, I think it's not going to happen very often. It'll be reassuring to people. It is a reminder to people who have a problem that say, well, go look at the law, retailer or whoever it is, or bank or institution, and remind them. I think that's really what we're doing here, not much more beyond stating a limited part of what is there.
Let me raise, then I'll pass, remove from that, and I'll
right.
raise another question.
under 2A, you provide that where the creditor shows by a preponderance of the evidence that the violation was not intentional, he has an affirmative defense. 2B then says where in violating Section 1, the creditor acted in good faith, he is also not liable. But you don't say anything in there about whether the burden is on the creditor or the plaintiff to show good faith. And I wonder, in order to avoid a problem, we ought to decide that one way or the other and stick it in. I would think that we would want to say that the creditor shows by a preponderance of evidence that it acted in good faith, so that would make it clear that's an affirmative defense under 2B, just as it is under 2A. Do you have any problem with that, Frank?
No.
I'd move that as a...
Do we know what that is? Would you define that a little bit clearly?
It's on page 2.
Okay.
In line... the end of line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, after the word creditor, add the phrase shows by a preponderance of evidence that it.
That would be line 6.
Yeah, I guess you'd add it at the beginning of line 6 or the end of line 5. Take your choice.
That acted in good faith? Yeah. Is it if that you act in good faith?
Is it it or he? Well, I don't know which pronoun you use.
I assume that they would.
Oh, no, not there.
No, counting down, that'd be like...
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. You're right, John. You're right. Yeah. Mr. Brenneman, Senator Brenneman corrected me. It is at the end of line 6. We're in violating section 1A of the creditor.
Right here.
Right.
So it's the same line that the B is on.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendments, and we'll have this whole thing LC'd, and there may or may not be a that or an extra that in there by the time we get through, but it's
right, that,
we'll take it down for conforming.
Right.
Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Actually, we have not adopted the amendment yet that Senator Hill's proposed the proposed substitute for House Bill 2488 as we have just amended it.
Yes, right. I'll take Senator Shoemaker's amendment as a friendly amendment to moving proposed substitute for HB 2488.
Okay. Are there objections to that amendment? Okay, hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Yes.
I'll move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shoemaker has moved House Bill 2488 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Thank you very much. Jack, we're going to take House Bill 2470.
Yes.
We took this off the floor today. Is this the one?
Yes, ma'am. This was on the floor.
Who's here with amendments?
I have the amendments. Mr. Swank is here from the State Court Administrator.
State Court Administrator amendments.
The amendments are -4. They're a relatively minor technical amendment. State Court Administrator feels that they're necessary. There's an explanation prepared by Mr. Blank. Mr. Swank. Attached to the amendment.
Oops. Okay.
Is this for George Joseph? Or?
This may be for George Joseph. Jack or Brad, who's going to come up and tell us why you needed it? Oh, first, the chair would move that we would consider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2470 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Are there objections to that? Hearing none, so ordered. The bill is back before us.
For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. This amendment that you have before you would put some language in engrossed House Bill 2470 that was in the original amendments presented by the State Court Administrator's Office to this committee and did not end up in the printed bill. When I noticed that the language was not in the printed bill, I checked with Jack. The language is important because it was put in the original proposed amendments specifically to prohibit to limit the possibility of judges using this new section in an attempt to get around work that this committee has done in House Bill, or in Senate Bill 835, a criminal judgments bill, and in the sentencing guidelines by not imposing a sentence or not imposing a judgment, but just using an order to put somebody on probation. We need judges to enter judgments in criminal cases, and both the criminal judgment bill and the sentencing guidelines contemplate that, so we did not want to create the possibility of judges interpreting this section to say that they could impose probation by order if there were no judgment. And since the language wasn't there, I mentioned it to Jack. Jack acted quickly, and it's back before you.
Yes, any questions? And is there a motion then on the...
Mr. Chairman, I'll move a dash A4 amendment.
Yes, Senator Brenneman moves the HB 2470-A4 amendments dated 6-14-89, identifies LC 2034. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Not supported?
Chairman, I'll move it as amended, not reported.
Yes, Senator Brenneman moves HB 2470 as amended, the floor to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Not, then a committee assistant will call the roll.
Senator Brenneman.
Aye.
Senator
Brock. Aye.
Senator Brenneman.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Pro-Chair Hill.
Aye. Okay, yes, then we'll now move to, sort of, we'll now move to our work session on House Bill 2469.
Members of the committee, this is the third of our trilogy of wire bills. This is the omnibus bill, and just for your ease of reference, I'd remind the committee that sections 1 through 5 deal with mobile tracking. Sections 6 through 13 deal with cordless phones and digital pagers. Section 14 is a cordless phone. And
Counselor, this one's going to be quite involved, as I understand it. Should we proceed with the others then first? Or?
Well, Senator, the wire bill, 2469, as well as 2282, are both quite involved. The remaining one is 2251. Which is a complex topic, but there's only been one amendment proposed.
Okay, let's try House Bill 2251. Is that the joinder?
Yes.
Bill? Let's work with that one first.
Right. The only amendment to this bill, Senator, is the one proposed by Mr. Hennings that's now been through LC. You may recall that the proposal by Mr. Hennings.
I think we ought to talk to the body water first, since we could. This was a simpler bill. This is an up or down type of piece, but
the problem is we got session coming up pretty quickly.
Maybe I just do it and get this in up and under us.
Okay. Okay.
And all we'll right. Get excused from session because we do need to finish these bills today. Can you do that, Jack? Go ahead, please.
You recall the proposal by Mr. Hennings takes a different approach to the whole joinder question and requires that all offenses known by the prosecutor be brought together initially and then allows for severance of the trial, severance of the charges for trial upon motion of the state or the defendant. We had some considerable testimony from Mr. Hennings. I believe most of the committee was here at the time.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Grinsky?
If I could ask Jack a question, the practical effect of this, I was reading as you were speaking, maybe you hit it, but all charges are to be joined in one document, but what happens for purposes of a trial? Are they joined without the motion automatically, or is it the other way around?
That language is down in lines 13 and 14, Senator. Upon the trial of the charges within a charging document, the court shall, upon the request of the defendant or the state, sever each charge for trial, except in those circumstances where joinder is allowed now. In other words, same act or transaction.
and those charges would be tried in a single trial unless there would be undue prejudice to the defendant.
Okay. Pleasure of the committee.
Madam Chair. Senator Brennan, you were making noise before I did.
So. I was just getting ready to offer a motion to send 2251A to the floor with a due pass with no further amendments.
Okay, you have to speak to your discussion. Anybody, there's a discussion about that, Senator Hill?
Oh, he was getting ready to.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, as I recall, the discussion was is that this is essentially, the original bill is essentially based on federal court legislation, and that there is case law that deals with this, specifically with this legislation. And although I was, I thought that Mr. Henning's testimony was persuasive, I'm not sure what we're getting to and deviating from what is from the federal legislation, where there's already been litigation on what it means. So I tend to agree with Senator Brennan. So, but whatever.
Okay.
You can still separate them under lines 21 and 22, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, if I could also,
we had
discussion last time about the language on line 19, court may order them to be consolidated versus shall order them to be consolidated. Did we get that resolved? And everyone wants to leave it at may?
Well, I certainly, you're talking about the existing bill, line 21.
Right.
I think we ought to leave it at may. If we're going to pass the bill, we certainly don't, we want to leave some flexibility there.
Well, I'm not at all thrilled with the amendment, so I agree with Senator Brennan on it.
Okay.
I'll place that motion.
Yes, Senator Brennan.
2251 to A, no further amendments to the floor, do pass.
Senator Brennan has moved House Bill 2251 and goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.